everybody. Good to see you. Thanks for joining tonight. We can share our recovery together. Of course, Kevin Griffin has also been one of my teachers. I should say that. I've known him for quite a long time now, and have benefited greatly from his wise bringing together, Buddhism and the 12 steps in particular. So tonight, I thought I would keep. Kevin's been doing a step a month, and I thought tonight I would keep that going because I don't want you to, if people are coming every month, I don't want you to miss a step. So we'll be talking about step seven. Humbly asked, quote, him to remove our shortcomings, but it'll be in a Buddhist context, and there'll be time for questions and comments at the end, sharing. But I believe we usually start with a meditation period for about 30 minutes or so. So we'll go ahead and do that first. Get grounded, centered, chilled. And I'll ring a bell at the end that hopefully you'll be able to hear through Zoom if I set the right settings. So go ahead and find a comfortable posture for your meditation. This evening, whatever works for your body at this time is great. And you could, we often start with our eyes closed because it just kind of blocks things out a little bit and helps us go inward. But you could meditate with your eyes open. You just want to have a soft gaze a few feet in front of you. So once you've found that posture you're going to use, you might take a deep breath or two here at the beginning. Just as a way to settle the nervous system, arrive here more fully in this body, this present moment. And just noticing there is this body. Sitting here on the chair, cushion, or whatever posture you're in, the invitation is just to be aware there is this body. Feel the contact with the chair, cushion, floor. Feel the arms, feel the legs. And really, what we're doing is establishing mindfulness, the mindfulness of the body. And you might check in with the heart center too. Just notice what's here. Welcome it with a sense of kindness, care, curiosity. There could be all kinds of things, joy, fear. Everything in between, anger, irritation. We just bring our mindfulness to whatever's here. This moment is like this. And then you might take a moment or a few moments to settle the body a little further. So I usually start at the top of my head and work down, just softening around the eyes, relaxing the muscles in the face, maybe dropping the shoulders a little, not holding tension there, softening the belly, the whole upper torso, relaxing the legs, even the feet. Just letting things settle, calm down as best as we can. And with sounds, we're aware of sounds arising and passing away, maybe in the room where we are or outside the room. We try to let the sound mostly be in the background for a meditation usually, unless it's something we really need to address. The sound just arises and passes away like everything else. Then you might want to use the breath as an anchor for your meditation, or if you have a preferred anchor, please use that. I find the breath handy and helpful. Breathing in, I know that I'm breathing in. Breathing out, I know that I'm breathing out. So we can keep it pretty simple with that. We just allow the body to breathe naturally. No need to control the breathing in any way. We might notice that the mind is pretty busy. That would be very normal. we don't make a problem out of that. It's okay. It's normal. We just come back to the breath whenever we can remember to do so. Sometimes it's helpful to label the thoughts like planning. Often I'm planning a future pleasant experience after the meditation. So, just noticing our habit patterns of mind. See if we can let them go for now. Come back to the next breath. Really keep our awareness anchored in the present moment, in the body, in the breath. Sometimes sound is actually useful for mindfulness because it's always happening in the present moment too. So you can use an unexpected sound to kind of check in, notice if you were being aware or if you were lost in thought. One trick for working with an extra busy mind can be doing a short gratitude list. I learned this from a meditation teacher who specializes in concentration practice. So we just think of a few things we're grateful for in this moment. I'm grateful to be clean and sober today. Grateful for Spirit Rock hosting this event for us to be here together tonight. I'm grateful for the support from Ileana, who's here supporting us in the background. The gratitude list I find helps counteract a negative tendency of mind, thinking of everything wrong in this moment. When you're done with the gratitude practice, you can just let it go, come back to the next breath. Reconnect with the sense of this body sitting here. And you might just check in, notice if you're getting caught up in a compelling story, memory, plan. This is what we tend to do very naturally. And it's just while we're meditating, we try to let this go. The Buddha talked about it as proliferation of thought, and that it kind of gets in the way of our spiritual progress, in a sense. We try to simplify the mind, come back to the next breath, relax back into the body. Cultivating a natural sense of peace and ease. First part of the problem is we believe our thoughts. We get really identified with whatever we're thinking. And so we're really taken out of the present moment in a sense. Ultimately, we want to be the knower of the thoughts. We want to rest in the knowing awareness of mind. It seems really hard, and our mind is just super busy. That's okay. Just bring in kindness and compassion for ourselves. This mind is like this right now. Don't make a problem out of it. You start to get sleepy, which is another issue that comes up. You can always open your eyes, sit up straighter, take a few intentional deeper breaths. Oh, again, you might just check in, notice what's happening in the mind. See if you're lost in a story or if you're right there present with the breath and this body sitting here. It's not to beat ourselves up if we were lost in thought. Just come back. It's a moment of mindfulness whenever we notice that we were lost and are able to come back so we can celebrate those moments as well. When I first started, most of the time I was sitting in meditation was just lost in stories and plans. So this is a practice. We just keep coming back to the next breath when we remember to. Okay, so that concludes the meditation. When you're ready, you can open your eyes, come back to the Zoom screen, I guess. By the way, I want to just ask, is anybody here today for the first time to this group? Okay, welcome. Great. Welcome, everybody. Yeah, it's just nice to acknowledge people when they show up for the first time. And we're very happy to have you. It's funny, I'm a technically like a substitute teacher for Kevin Griffin tonight, but I've actually been one of his subs for over a decade at least, because I used to go, they used to have this group in person at Spirit Rock before COVID, and I used to do it. I was thinking of like people I know who have died who would be at the group in person. Like my daughter was born. So life happens, right? So anyway, great to have everybody here. And again, I'm gonna. So I've been in recovery for, 3.5 decades and counting. And but I didn't really find serious Buddhist practice until about 20 years ago. And so I was in recovery for a while. Without the sort of support of Buddhist practices and teachings, although I had been, seen Jack Kornfield speak at Spirit Rock in 1993 or whatever. But it really changed my recovery when I started practicing more seriously insight meditation specifically, and going on regular retreats and things like that. So anyway, it's always a privilege and to speak at a Spirit Rock related group, because that's really where I got my start. And Jack Kornfield was my first Buddhist teacher. Tonight I just thought, as I said earlier, I would talk about step seven. The official, 12-step version is humbly, keyword humbly, asked, quote, I say, quote, him to remove our shortcomings. The hymn refers to God. That's from step six. It says, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character that we've listed in step four, and confessed in step five to our sponsor or whatever. And then it's interesting because it turns out Bill Wilson just didn't want to repeat these phrases like God and defects of character twice in a row, so that's why I changed it to him and shortcomings instead of defects of character. So shortcomings and defects of character were intended to be the same thing. And in Buddhism, we don't tend to use these terms, which Kevin talked about last month. So I tend to use the word defilements, which doesn't necessarily sound that much better, but we'll talk about that a little bit. Anyway, I do think this word humility, in the Alcoholics Anonymous book called The 12 Steps and the 12 Traditions, they emphasize humility in this particular step seven. It says, for without some degree of humility, no alcoholic, or addict can stay sober or clean at all, right? Without some degree of humility. And I will say, and then they go on to add that we also need to develop more humility than just what's required to stay clean and sober, or else we still don't have much of a chance of becoming truly happy. And I will say that humility has been part of my recovery path, in different ways. So, but it does tend to be more of a, I would say more of a Christian term than a Buddhist term, although humility is built into, like, if you're a Buddhist monastic, I was thinking about this, there's a lot of humility built into being a monastic. For one thing, the really hardcore Theravada monastics, they aren't allowed to grow food. And they're not allowed to store a lot of food food. So they really have to go out on alms round every day, and the community has to kind of offer them alms, offer them food. And but what's also interesting is they usually are required to walk barefoot through the villages. Like I was in Burma, Myanmar, at a monastery, and they let us. I didn't ordain, but I went on alms round every morning with the monks at this monastery, and they're required to be barefoot, and they're walking on these hard dirt roads all around these villages. And I think that's a certain level of humility that's built into that. And also, they all wear the same, shaven heads, robes the same color, so they're not supposed to kind of stand out. I think they're not supposed to even smile, and they're not supposed to say thank you when they receive the food. So there's a lot of interesting rules that I think are intended to cultivate a sense of humility. One of my favorite things was to try to get the young monks to smile or laugh during alms round. That's one of my defilements, I guess. But anyway, I have a great photo where I got this one kid that I really like to smile on the alms round. Anyway, I mean, he was smiling at my foibles because I was taking pictures of all kinds of stuff that he probably thought was a little weird. All right, so anyway, I was thinking also for me in recovery, humility has served me because I've had to sort of restart my career, so-called career, multiple times, right? And start from scratch, like, and I think through recovery, sort of the practice of recovery from alcoholism and drugs, I had a certain level of humility where I would do whatever job I could get at the time and then make the most of it and not just go in thinking I'm better than this or something. I did have the phrase, you are not your job, but I also had that idea of service of like, okay, this is the job I'm doing for now, and I'll do it to the best of my ability to be of, service to others. And we'll see what happens. But I think that was a useful quality that I probably didn't have so well when I was still drinking and using. And I looked up the, standard definition of humility, which is freedom from pride or arrogance, or the state, the quality or state of being humble. And it comes from the Latin word humilis, which means low. I found a quote I liked from C.S. Lewis, was like a Christian writer, but he said, "Humility is not thinking less of yourself; it's thinking of yourself less." That could be a Buddhist quote too. So I thought that was a nice phrase. I hadn't heard that one before. And in general, I even looked up, you've got Google AI, kind of do a Google search now, and AI gives you what's called an overview. So I kind of looked up, just curious what it would say for humility in Buddhism. And it said, and I'm not saying this is exactly right, but it said, in Buddhism, humility is not about self-deprecation or low self-esteem, but rather a deep understanding of one's true nature and the interconnectedness of all things. It involves recognizing one's limitations, acknowledging the contributions of others, and letting go of ego-driven desires and attachments. In essence, it goes on to say, Buddhist humility is a path to self-discovery, liberation, and genuine connection with others, which is nice. And it's about recognizing our place in the world, not as superior or inferior, but as part of a vast and interconnected web of life. So that was kind of interesting. Of course, it just takes all this data written about this topic and kind of brings it together. And it's sometimes wrong, I should say. And in fact, I looked up Kevin Griffin. I was just trying to get Kevin's website recently, and I did the same type of search for Kevin Griffin, just his name, knowing his website should come up. And it amalgamated. There's another famous musician named Kevin Griffin who was in a band. Was it Better Than Ezra? Some band. And it basically said that Kevin Griffin is a Buddhist meditation teacher and is in this band and was on this board. It just kind of created out of multiple Kevin Griffins, it turned it into one person. So yeah, just to say, it's interesting. It's not always right. And I looked up a tennis score for Wimbledon, and it was even wrong about that because it said that somebody had won the match when the match wasn't over yet. So that was interesting too. It wasn't counting anyway. So let's see. But I think this idea that we have these, well, I also, there's a quote from the Dhammapada I like, that this kind of sums up what we're doing in Buddhist practice. It says, doing no evil, engaging in what's skillful, and purifying one's mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha. Doing no evil, no unwholesome actions, harmful actions, engaging in what's skillful, what's wholesome, and purifying one's mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha. I think that's a good one to come back to again and again. And I listened to Kevin's talk from last month on step six, and he said some really interesting stuff. He said, as addicts, we didn't just do unwholesome things, but we also had unwholesome attitudes and thoughts. So just stopping the action isn't enough. Our minds are still the minds of addicts. And so a lot of the work in Dharma and recovery is the inner work of transforming the mind, purifying the mind. That means trying to cultivate wholesome behaviors, wholesome speech, and wholesome thinking and attitudes. So this is where the big challenge is, Kevin says. For people in recovery, it's the mind. This line is what jumped out at me because I really agree with it, and I've been talking about it a lot as well, about really when it comes down to it, the big benefit I get out of Buddhist practice and teachings is learning how to work with the mind and how to cultivate a more wholesome, skillful mind or wholesome, skillful thoughts. Because it's interesting, we hear a lot about karma in Buddhism, and karma is about thoughts and speech. No, well, sorry, it's about speech and actions, but it's also about thought. So thoughts just in and of themselves can create negative karma in Buddhist teachings, which is a little scary because we can have some pretty crazy thoughts sometimes, but that's okay. That it has less, there's less weight on thoughts in terms of karmic impact than speech and actions, but still there is some impact. So we do need to watch the mind. That's one of the things we learn, and this is all in the service, not of morality, but of less suffering. Oh, Kevin mentioned that too, but it's that the whole idea is that these unwholesome, unskillful thoughts really create a lot of the suffering that we experience in the world. It's really our, and we start to see this as we cultivate more and more mindfulness, we sort of refine our ability to see how this is operating all the time. And so this is sort of like the good news, bad news that it really will lead to less suffering, but it also means we're going to start to see our bad habits more clearly. I mean, for me, I was in recovery and doing lots of wholesome things, but I was all, and I actually worked at Spirit Rock for a long time as a staff member, and There's a country store near the near Spirit Rock proper, and I used to go there every day and get this sweetened green tea, right? And I never really looked at sort of what how much sugar was in it. It just I'm thinking I'm getting green tea. Green tea is good for you, right? But then I went to the doctor and got diagnosed with pre-diabetes. And I started to realize that all these green teas I was drinking were actually contributing to my bad health, you know. And so I had to cut them out and just start drinking sparkling water a lot. Because and then it was interesting. I stopped drinking those teas that I was pretty attached to. And then I was off them for maybe a year, and I went and just got one to try it again. And it tasted so sweet, I kind of like spit it out. I mean, so it had really, my perception of it really shifted. There was a lot more sugar in it than I had realized at the time. So these are things that, you know, a friend of mine in recovery used to always say, more will be revealed. And I think we have to have the humility to allow more to keep being revealed, right? So just to keep being open to seeing our sort of bad habits that are causing us suffering does take a certain level of humility. I do agree with that. So it's not always, you know, what we want, but it is what kind of the way things go. And yeah, Kevin had talked last month about, you know, how do we change, which is just an important question. And that's kind of what the topic for me tonight really is about, is how do we change? And mindfulness is the key. I mean, one of my teachers has been Sayadaw Utejaniya in recent years that I've learned a lot from. Also, Joseph Goldstein emphasizes this and wrote a book called Mindfulness that I highly recommend. But both of these teachers just really talk about the key is mindfulness. And we refine the mind in a way through mindfulness. And it happens gradually over time. We don't have to make every giant change today, right? So also there's compassion. We may not be ready to give up our, you know, sweet green tea today, but we might at least cut back on it or something, you know, start to notice, oh, this could be part of the problem. So we just have to be open to discovery, I guess. And Joseph Goldstein, who I just mentioned, you know, one of the key words, one of the reasons that we even, you know, get onto the path of recovery, much less the path of Buddhist practice, is when we start to notice that we're suffering. You know, pain is the touchstone that gets us to change. I mean, for me, I woke up in jail out of a blackout. I didn't even remember why I was in jail. And it was miserably, I was feeling pain on every level, basically. Turns out I'd been in a car accident. My head th went through the windshield, stuff like that. So I had a big black eye. I was super hungover. I was distraught because I didn't even remember why I was there. It was a pretty low point. And, you know, that definitely started to make me ready to change. I literally had some kind of weird, almost like a vision or a thought of like, you must change your life. There's a famous poem from Rilke, I think it is. And the last line, it's kind of like a torso of Apollo or something. And he's describing a beautiful Greek statue. And then out of the blue, the last line of the poem is, you must change your life, something like that. And it kind of felt like that. It's like I woke up in jail out of a blackout. And really the first thought was, you must change your life. Then I went and saw the car, and there was the shape of my head bashed into the windshield. You know, when a windshield breaks, it kind of still, there's a layer of it that holds together. Like, so you could basically put my head in the hole. It was like a perfect fit. But that r really realized, you know, on many levels, I could have hurt somebody else. Fortunately, I hit a parked car on a dead end street. But anyway, so Joseph Goldstein has this definition of suffering, or dukkha is the Pali word, the Buddhist word that we use, dukkha. So he says one definition of dukkha is the inevitability of unwanted experiences. The inevitability of unwanted experiences, which I love that definition. Because I know, as a sort of an addict type person, addictive type of person, I really didn't like unwanted experiences. And I still don't. I can get kind of jarred when something really unexpected happens, right? And so these, mindfulness allows me to start to be more open, and humility as well allow me to be open to unwanted experiences. It's like, oh, okay, so this is what's happening now. Whether I like it or not, it doesn't really matter a lot of the time. If I have a flat tire on the freeway, that's a very unwanted experience, but having a bad attitude about it won't fix my tire. This happened to me one time driving. Of course, I was trying to get to a Buddhist teaching event on a Friday morning in rush hour traffic. And I was on a bridge approaching a toll booth, and all of a sudden my car starts going thump 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 thump. I don't know how. I guess I ran over a nail. And I was like, there were literally like 12 lanes of traffic, and I was in the middle of it. It's like the worst place to have a flat tire. And talk about an unwanted experience. Somehow I got my car all the way over to the shoulder, because I didn't want to just be the cause of the worst traffic of, the month or whatever. So I just got my car over to the shoulder. And then, anyway, it's a long, I decided to change the tire myself, but I'd never even looked at the equipment that the German car company provided. Had a German car at the time. When I opened it, it looked so complex. Like, I guess they were trying to fit it. It was a small car, and they were trying to fit the. So anyway, it took a really long time to change the flat. But I had this wonderful thought during this time, because I really wanted to get to this Buddhist teaching as fast as possible. So anyway, but I had this thought, because I started to lose it at some point, like, oh my God, this is more than I can handle. And then I had the thought, well, by this time tomorrow, like tomorrow morning at this time, I will have figured this out. I won't still be here on the side of the road. And somehow, just that sort of reminder to myself, it was to me a little moment of mindfulness. It's like, okay, wait, take a breath. All right, somehow I will figure this out. And it really just gave me the space to then figure it out. And then I was able to change the tire and get where I was going. And I was late, but not too late. So, yeah, but that was sort of a great example of how the teachings and the practice really kind of helped me get through something that, for me, like when I was still drinking and using, would have been very, I would have, thrown the tire iron at something, or, would have broken something. Just wouldn't have gone nearly as well. And Christina Feldman, in a book called The Boundless Heart, she's another senior insight meditation teacher. She's been called the granny of mindfulness, because Jon Kabat-Zinn was on a retreat with her when he came up with the idea for something called mindfulness-based stress reduction, MBSR. So anyway, she writes, a Zen master was once asked, "What is the secret of your happiness?" And he answered, "Complete, unrestricted cooperation with the unavoidable." And the unavoidable is our life. It's the flat tire, it's whatever. But I love that. The secret to his happiness: complete, unrestricted cooperation with the unavoidable. And that definitely was not, my attitude in the past was not that, right? Cooperation with what I wanted to avoid, what I didn't want. So, or at least escape it. And Kevin looked at his chapter on step seven in One Breath at a Time, his Buddhism and the 12 Steps book. And Kevin Griffin writes, true sobriety is not ordinary life with the drugs and alcohol cut out. It's a new way of living, of relating to ourselves and to the world. It's not a different version of the life we are living. It's a completely new life, one that can't be imagined until you are there. And it's both appealing and frightening, he says. I love that he adds frightening as well. It's appealing and frightening. And my whole journey of recovery, right, is I just love that because it's really, that's been what it is, you know. It's funny, I don't go to a lot of reunions from my past, like that involve all the people I used to drink and use with, because maybe because I'm just so, my life is so different now in every way than it was back then. And I guess I'm worried I won't relate to the people anymore, but I should really try one of these reunion things. I seem to be getting invited to more and more lately. But I love what Kevin is saying there, and I think it's really important too. And this is, again, we have to have the humility to think, to be willing to let ourselves go in that direction of living a different life. And it is a little frightening, and hopefully it'll be a better life. And I know for me, I have no regrets, you know. I mean, I wouldn't have chosen for my life to be the way it is. I wasn't expecting. It's very surprising to me that the life I'm living today, but I wouldn't change it, you know. It is a satisfying life, and there's no way I could have planned for this, right? And you know, I have a wonderful daughter and wife, and we have a new puppy, and it's all that stuff is fantastic. But really, the best part of my day tends to be my meditation, right? It's just that, just coming back to the simplicity of the peace and natural peace and ease that is our natural peace and ease, as one monk, Ajahn Amaro, puts it. That just this, just coming back to like, just what's here. Just kind of dropping all the drama and just being present and peaceful for a few moments. It's really a nice part of my day. And then that allows me to be more present for the people in my life and things like that. And, you know, in the AA 12 and 12 book, it says, they get a little dramatic. It says, you know, for thousands of years, we have been demanding more than our share of security, prestige, and romance. Never was there enough of what we thought we wanted. And in all of these strivings, so many of them well-intentioned, our crippling handicap had been our lack of humility. We had lacked the perspective to see that character building and spiritual values had to come first, and that material satisfactions were not the purpose of living. And this does agree. I was thinking this is even though it has, you know, humbly asked him, and we don't, it'd be so easy if the him could just be the Buddha, but that's really not how it works with Buddhism, right? The Buddha was not a god. We can take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, and that's a beautiful way to practice. But the Buddha wasn't some kind of creator god or perfect human. He was enlightened, liberated. But the idea is that all of us can be enlightened, liberated as well. He just showed the way. And but other than that, I still think this is a very Buddhist step in some way, because there are lists, you know. We don't use the term shortcomings in Buddhism. They tend to use that word, defilements, instead. But there are similar lists. So in the 12-step literature, the so-called defects of character are things like resentment, anger, fear, self-pity, self-justification, lying, dishonesty, impatience. I think that's a good one. False pride, phoniness, jealousy, envy, laziness, procrastination. This is a list I found, but these are a lot of the what they mean by character defects. Greed. And so then there's a sutta called the Simile of the Cloth Sutta, an ancient Buddhist discourse where the Buddha lists some similar things. He talks about them as he called them imperfections that defile the mind. He's talking to some monastics, I think, and he says, "What are the imperfections that defile the mind?" And they are covetousness, and unrighteous greed, ill will, anger, resentment, contempt, insolence, envy, avarice, deceit, fraud, obstinacy, rivalry, conceit, arrogance, vanity, and negligence. So, pretty similar type of list. And I just think it's interesting that we have these lists in both the traditional 12-step literature and in Buddhist teachings. And the Buddha talks about it as, that we give up, expel, release, abandon, and relinquish these imperfections of mind. So it's a letting go, really. But I kind of like the word abandon in particular, that we abandon the defilements of mind, because I feel like that's the most useful way that I've found to kind of look at it, is that when I see that this whatever, so-called defilement I have, when I see that it's actually causing me and possibly other people suffering more than anything else, and when I really see that clearly, then it becomes pretty easy to abandon it, to just realize this is not serving me or anybody else. I really need to let this go. And it's not, what I find is it kind of it's gradual, but I might make a decision like I'm really not going to do this anymore, but then it'll repeat, but it'll start, but the more I bring mindfulness to it, the quicker I am to release it, abandon it, let it go. And then over time, it just kind of comes back less and less a lot. So it's not, it's not just like one time and you're done usually. But I like the Buddhist way of talking about these things. The other side of this is that in Buddhism, we have these positive qualities called the paramis or perfections that we can develop or cultivate. And so they also help us, when we're emphasizing generosity, loving kindness, patience, these are the paramis. When we're emphasizing these, then they tend to reduce the opposite, right? They have the effect. So what I also love is that the Buddhist practices allow me to cultivate these very wholesome things, and that we can start to value lists like this. I'll give you the whole list of the paramis in the chat if the chat will let me. Because that's one list, and then there's even the Pali words with them. And there's an emphasis on truthfulness, to see or know things in an undistorted way, and but also that we wouldn't tell lies and things. And all of this, these are the qualities that it was said that the Buddha had cultivated that led to him being the Buddha, this enlightened being. So these are qualities that we can start cultivating, and we start where we are, right? It's not that we have to be perfect at any of these from the get-go, but And a lot of times when the Buddha was giving teachings, especially to people who hadn't heard him speak before, what he emphasized first was generosity and then morality, which is just, non-harming other beings, focusing on non-harming. But I love that, just that idea of even focusing on generosity. It develops a sense of connectedness with others, as it says there. But it also lessens stinginess or greed, right? If we're really, and this has been a gradual thing. I remember quite a few years ago now, but I moved in to a house with a fellow person in recovery, and I just remember that this guy was a lot more naturally generous than me. And I started to see my stinginess more clearly in comparison to his natural generosity. And so I learned a lot from that experience of like, oh, wow, I didn't realize how stingy I was until I saw how generous people can be. And that was a good teaching for me. So I love that in Buddhism we have these positive qualities that we can be cultivating, and they will naturally reduce the so-called defilements of mind that they say kind of stain the mind. There's in the simile of the cloth, I'll just share it with you because I think it's kind of memorable. The Buddha is with a bunch of, they call them bhikkhus, or we'll just say practitioners, followers, and ancient India. And he says, bhikkhus, suppose a cloth were defiled and stained or dirty, and a dyer, somebody who dyes things, a dyer dipped it in some dye or other, whether blue or yellow or red or carmine, it would look poorly dyed and impure in color. Why is that? Because of the impurity of the cloth. So the cloth was dirty to begin with, and then when you dip it in the dye, it doesn't dye evenly. And then he says, so too, when the mind is defiled, an unhappy destination may be expected. This brings in, in this context, brings in rebirth. You'd be reborn in a hell realm or an animal kingdom or in the realm of ghosts, whatever that is. But also, you're just going to be unhappy, is part of the idea. And then he says, suppose a cloth were pure and bright and a dyer dipped it in some dye or other. So if it's not dirty, it's a pure, bright, clean cloth, then it would look well dyed and pure in color. Why is that? Because of the purity of the cloth. So too, when the mind is undefiled, a happy destination may be expected. So, as we, and we talk a lot about the what defiles the mind, it comes from the three unwholesome roots of greed, hatred, and delusion. Greed, it kind of all goes back to greed, hatred, and delusion in one way or the other. And so, as we purify the mind, we are, moving towards less suffering and greater happiness, greater peace of mind, contentment, ease. I mean, there's also something in a phrase called the bliss of blamelessness, right? I remember when I was drinking and using, and I was always worried about like police cars, right? Because it's a long time ago, but and even after I got into recovery, I remember still kind of being freaked out every time I saw a police car for a while, because it was coming from sort of the defiled mind is always guilty, right? And then over the years, it just now I see a police car and I think, oh, somebody's in trouble and they're hopefully going to help them, or like I'm not even at all paranoid anymore, which is quite a change. So, just interesting, the bliss of blamelessness. If we're not doing anything blameworthy, then we have no reason to look back over our shoulder. And the longer I've been in recovery, and the longer I've been following the Buddhist path quite seriously, there's just no There's more and more ease in the world, and my mind is much more calm and tranquil, you might say. I mean, that doesn't mean I don't get agitated sometimes when things get stressful or something. But even then, I know how to deal with it much better. So, but again, it takes many years. We keep cultivating this practice, and hopefully, we see the results. The Dalai Lama said, don't look for the results in the short term. See how you've changed over 5 years or 10 years. So, there's that too. But, and meditation itself, right, takes some humility, some Kevin Griffin, and he calls it his like humble meditation, right? That there's some level of humility required to value sitting still and doing nothing for 30 minutes a day or whatever it is. I remember I went to a retreat in England one time. It's a long story, but it was at a Buddhist monastery in England with a famous teacher, Ajahn Sumedho, who was somebody I was, it was one of his last times he was ever going to offer a retreat to lay people. So I got lucky enough to get into the retreat on a lottery. So I ended up going. But when I went to through customs in the UK in the like London Heathrow Airport, there was a customs guy who was like about my age at the time, maybe in his early 40s or something. And he's like, so, you know, what's your destination and what are you going to be doing here in the in this country? He's looking at the paperwork and it says I'm basically going out to this monastery, which is kind of in just out in the countryside. And he just sort of looks angry and he's like, so basically you flew all this way to go sit out in a cow field and do nothing for 2 weeks? And I said, yes, you're exactly right. That's it. And he stamped my passport and said, get the hell out of here or something. He was like truly angry about it. Like, so, you know, because it is kind of a humble thing that literally, I mean, I spent like one and a half days in London or something. But for the most part, I just went out to this monastery and did sitting and walking and listening to the teacher's talks. And cultivating, you know, these wholesome qualities we're talking about. And it was a wonderful experience, right? But it's not that exciting on the surface, I guess, to a non practitioner. Yeah, it's a humble path we're on, but it's rewarding in its own way. Joseph Goldstein, in his book Mindfulness, writes, so each of us, in our own way, can plant and water the seeds of right thought and a kind heart. And slowly, they will grow and become the guiding principles of our lives. And even at those times when we're not acting from this place of wisdom and compassion, even at those times, you know, when we're kind of off, he says, it can still be the reference point that reminds us of other choices. So even when we're acting out a little bit, in the back of our minds, we still remember this path, that these seeds that we've planted with whatever amount of practice we have done, they will often kind of come back to us and just, and they're these powerful reminders of, you know, what's possible, what path we could be on. You know, Jack Kornfield tells a story of, walking through the airport in Miami, and this older man comes excitedly running up to him and says, Jack, I don't, you probably don't remember me. I sat a retreat with you 20 years ago, you know, and then I kind of stopped practicing for a long time. And then I had a terrible diagnosis of some kind of cancer or something, and I ended up in the hospital. And the practice that you taught us on that retreat came flooding back to me on the in the hospital bed, and it really saved me. And it really helped me get through that very difficult experience. So I just want to thank you so much. And then the guy like ran away, you know, went off. But I just love that because it, yeah, these are seeds that we're planting when we show up for the practice and these teachings. But we never know quite how it's gonna influence our lives. But certainly, I believe that it's been very beneficial in my own life. And there's a famous quote in Buddhism that the Buddha apparently said, which is, again, bhikkhu could be us. It's like anybody who's a close follower of the Buddha or Buddhism says, bhikkhus, whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of their mind. Whatever we frequently think and ponder upon, that's the habit of mind that we're creating. So he says, if one frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of sensual desire, for example, or hatred or ill will, one has abandoned the thought of renunciation or kindness to cultivate the thought of sensual desire or the thought of ill will. And then their mind inclines to thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, whatever it is. So, or we can incline the mind. We can keep coming back to this practice. We can cultivate these more wholesome qualities of loving kindness, generosity, compassion, and renunciation as well. Kevin talks about renunciation in the chapter on step seven in his One Breath at a Time book. And that, it's a word that we don't always love in, Western parlance or whatever, but I've come to really, appreciate the word renunciation. I'll just end by saying that when I looked back at that retreat that I did in Myanmar, or could be the one in England as well, but the one that I did in Myanmar in particular, the food wasn't really quite nourishing enough for me. I started to like lose weight and whatever. And the bed was more like a metal table with a thin pad on it. And my normal creature comforts were gone, right? But when I really look back at my time there, I don't think I've ever been happier than I was when I was at this particular Buddhist monastery in Myanmar. I mean, really, I had a very palpable sense of happiness and well-being while I was there, even though my normal, sense desire, sensual realm was challenged. So it's all in that way, it's a little mysterious sometimes too. But that was, there was a lot of renunciation in that experience. And yet, I don't think I've ever been happier. So I think I should end there because I just realized the time and I want to hear from some of you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.